it looks like y'all expect me to say something. Well, here we are. So one of the announcements that I asked Jennifer to skip today, because I knew I was going to talk a little bit about it in the service, was that on April 14th, our friend Nipun Mehta is coming. Some of you are new and maybe don't know who he is. I consider him to be probably my primary spiritual teacher at this point in my life. He was brought to us by chance probably 7 or 8 years ago through a series of weird emails and coincidences, and since that time, the consciousness in the church has really shifted. I believe that we've gotten much more into the acts of kindness, into greater humility, into a greater mystical sense of being who we are truly called to be. So Nipun is coming on April 14th. He's also the person that I went to India with a little over a year ago, and he's bringing a friend from India whose name is Arun Bhatt, or Arun Dada, which is a term of endearment. Arun is someone that traveled with the person known as Gandhi's spiritual successor. So Gandhi was assassinated, as you know, and then one of his devotees was named Vinoba Bhave. He took up where Gandhi left off, and one of his great claims to fame or whatever, I don't know that he's really famous, but he went one by one and did a pilgrimage across India. He walked across India to lots of local farmers that were wealthy and asked them to parcel out portions of their land to people that had nothing so that the land could be cultivated by those that needed the land. So it was this remarkable achievement of getting wealthy people to share their resources with people that didn't have so much. Arun traveled with Vinoba, and he's coming to our center with Nipun, I was going to say Gandhi, but with Nipun on the 14th. Now, he doesn't speak English, so it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds and what the deal is, but we'll just, you know, play, have fun with it. I want to tell you a story about Arun Bhatt that I read online as I was doing some research for him. And this is more to the point of what this talk is about. It's about the paradox of power. And it's a story about the power of this gentle man. So after he finished traveling, he was gifted a house. Arun and his wife were gifted a house. And they moved into their home. And they realized that the person living next door to them was a horrible neighbor. Has anyone here ever had a horrible neighbor? We don't need to speak of it. But that's one of those things, really, that money can't buy. It's so good to have a great neighbor. But anyway, this man was very loud. He also ran a catering business, and the caterers would dump all of their stuff onto Arun and his wife's front yard. And so Arun spoke to the caterers, and he said, you know, we're vegetarians, and we also drink alcohol, so we can't have this stuff on our front yard. You're going to have to find a different place. Well, the mean neighbor found out about it, and he came over, and he was drunk, and he was yelling, and he was cursing, and he slapped Arun in the face, and he broke his glasses, and he threw his glasses into a river. And Arun just stepped back and decided to meditate on what had happened. The neighbor went his separate way, and Arun decided to meditate. The next day, the neighbor's wife came over, and she was very contrite, and she was saying, I know my husband broke your glasses. Here's some money. Can we get you new glasses? And Arun said, no, sister, my prescription was old. I need to get new glasses anyway, so keep your money. It's okay. So nothing really shifted in the relationship between Arun and the neighbor for a while. The neighbor would get on the phone and have these loud conversations where he was cursing and screaming and yelling, and he'd be drunk, and Arun and his wife would just be there, okay, we're going to meditate, we're going to see the good, we're going to meditate. I don't know that I would have reacted in the same fashion. But anyway, one day, Arun was overhearing his neighbor's conversation on the phone, and he was yelling and cursing, and at the end of the conversation, though, he said, Jai Shri Krishna. Now, imagine somebody yelling, cursing, and then at the end of the conversation, oh, by the way, praise God, right? That's what it was. He was yelling, cursing, and then at the end, Jai Shri Krishna. Glory to Krishna, which is love and compassion, right? To beloved Krishna. So, Arun had a thought. He approached the neighbor one day when the neighbor was out walking, and he said, Brother, I heard you say Jai Shri Krishna to the person you were speaking to on the phone. What if when you and I saw each other, we were to say Jai Shri Krishna to one another? And so they started that tradition. At first it was kind of like Jai Shri Krishna, you know. But then it started getting more overt, and they would actually look forward to seeing each other and saying, Jai Shri Krishna, glory to beloved Krishna, glory to love. And one time, the neighbor walked by, and Arun was reading in his front yard, and the neighbor didn't say Jai Shri Krishna. And Arun stopped him and he said, wait, you didn't say Jai Shri Krishna. And the neighbor said, oh, I saw that you were reading. I didn't want to be inconsiderate. And this progressed until they became good friends. And the moral of the story in the article that I read says that not only do we seek the good in people, we get to amplify the good in people. And that is true power. It's not, you know, he could have reacted with aggression, he could have reacted with force, he could have tried to drive out hatred and violence with hatred and violence, but instead he reacted with peace and with love and compassion. I guess following Gandhi's spiritual successor all those years had a positive impact on him. But the truth is that we don't need to follow Gandhi's spiritual successor. We don't need anything but our conscience and our awareness and our recognizing that there truly is this one perfect life that is here for us, and that as we open our hearts to receive it through practices such as compassion, nonviolence, patience, peace, that we really do enter into that place where we have true power, the paradox of power. Those of you who come here a lot know that I talk a lot about paradox. I have been called a paradork in my time, which is a lover of paradox. I think I've told you that the state of California would not let me get a license plate that said paradork. I think it's a bad word in certain circles. But anyway, the part of it is. Anyway, you know, to me, in case you haven't heard me speak about paradox before, in case you don't know what it is, to me, one of the ways to consider paradox is to think that it's two irreconcilable things, things that are hard to hold in your brain that don't really reconcile, but somehow they do, in some mystical way, they do reconcile. It's a paradox. Examples of paradox are things like it is in giving that we receive, right? Your ego is saying, wait a minute. It's in receiving that we receive. It's in hoarding that we receive. But paradox says, no, it is in giving that we receive. Another one, which speaks to the story that I told about Arun Dada, is love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, right? Those are paradoxes. And the reason that I like paradox so much is that I am also obsessed with absolute reality as a name of God. That place, that Rumi's field that Hugh spoke about in the reading, the place beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, that place where the world is too full to talk about. When we lie down on that grass, the soul relaxes, and we know that there is something mystical, something beautiful that is here for us. So paradox kind of throws our ego off balance and catapults us into Rumi's field when we allow it to be. And when we're there, we get to surrender. And that is the power. The power of paradox, or the paradox of power. Surrender to what, though? You know, I started thinking about this a lot this week. What are we actually surrendering to? Because you can surrender, you can release and let go and let the Spirit run your life. Ernest Holmes, I read his chapter on spiritual power this week in Can We Talk to God, which is one of his many books. And Ernest Holmes says that we surrender to the I that is greater than what we are, but also infuses what we are. The I am presence, that thing that we sing about every Sunday. I am remembering who I am. We are remembering that there is this I presence, right? This I presence that is omnipresent, that is wholeness, that is Rumi's field, but it is also part of us. So we get out of the way and we allow that I presence to work through us. Some might also call that surrendering to truth. Some might also call it surrendering to a greater love that wants to be born through us. I'm beginning to think that love is truth and truth is love. They are the same thing. The truth that is truly true is always loving. You know, when you think about the 12 steps, the first step, I don't have the 12 steps memorized, but I know that the first step is that you recognize that you are powerless over your addiction, right? And then what do you do after that? You say that there is a higher power that can restore us to sanity, right? And then after that, you turn your life over to that power. That sounds like a good plan to me, right? There are a lot of people, I don't know if this is still true in this movement, but there, when people are coming into this movement and recognizing, you know, we're telling you, you are beautiful, you are powerful, you are one with God, they're like, well, how can I possibly say that I'm powerless over my addiction then? Is that wrong? But your ego is powerless over the addiction. There is a part of you that is completely powerful, but we get to that place of power through by knowing that we are powerless. Talk about a paradox, right? By knowing that the ego is powerless, we claim greater power for ourselves. And what this means to me, what I've been thinking about this week, you know, in terms of Rumi's field, in terms of being powerless, in terms of surrendering to love and truth as the same thing, it means to me that in every rightness, there is a wrongness. In every rightness, every time I think I'm right, there's a little bit of wrongness in that. You know, because I can't necessarily see into the hearts of other people. It's that thing of touching your elbow where I have you touch your elbow. You can do it if you want. We've done it a lot. But touch your elbow and then I ask, are you touching your body? And you say yes, and that's true. But are you touching your entire body? Right? You're not. Right? So it's the same type of thing. There is a wrongness in every rightness means that I am touching a piece of truth and I'm calling this truth absolute reality when really it is just my perception, and there are many, many other perceptions around that are great. And not only is there a wrongness in every rightness, I think that there is a rightness in every wrongness. That one's a little harder. That one's a little harder to justify when horrible things happen. But when we step back, we can see that there is a perfect plan, a perfect power that is unfolding, and that everything that has happened is happening for a reason. And if it's something that we struggle with, that struggle is part of the reason. If it's something that causes us to suffer, that suffering is part of the reason. Everything that happens, happens for a purpose, and the purpose is always to awaken more love in us, in the people around us, in the world. The awakening of the world happens through individual awakening, and we are called to do that every time something happens, something that we don't like. There is a rightness in every wrongness, and the key is to find the gift, to find that truth. So if you sit with those paradoxes for a bit, you might open up to different experiences of life, particularly different experiences of those people that get in your way, those people that work your nerves. Last week I spoke about trying people, meaning people that were difficult, people that try your patience. And I remember last week I spoke about how when you pick a talk title like that, if you pick a talk title and say, I'm going to learn about trying people come out of the woodwork to try your patience, don't they? What did not occur to me, though, was that I could be a trying person. Perhaps that fact has occurred to some of you, but it did not occur to me until I became a trying person last week. Well, not just last week, probably every day in one way or another. But I got to see how I was trying somebody's patience. Somebody got really mad at me last week, and I have permission to talk about this, and it's not you, okay? If you're thinking it's you, it's not you, because I had a conversation with the person about it, and I said that I was going to speak about it. So this person, after I did this talk about trying people, she wrote to me, she said, I just wrote you a 2-page letter that I'm not going to send, but we need to talk. We need to talk. Wanted you to hear that over the sneeze. Those hurting words, we need to talk. So the first place I went was to consider the letter, you know. I thought about, I visualized the letter, and it had little tiny font. Like eight that you can hardly see, and there were no paragraphs, and it was just a stream of consciousness, and it was 2 pages front and back, and it was all about what was wrong with me. Boy, howdy, I can't wait to hear about this. But it was interesting, you know, and I credit the community for this. Of course, I started feeling a little bit defensive and a little bit like on the attack, well, I'm not wrong, you're the one who's wrong, you know. But I credit this community with supporting me and all of us with so much love. You know, we learn so many skills here that can help us move from a place of reactivity into a place of responsibility. And so I worked on some of the stuff that Chris taught us last week with the breathing, counting to five. And I worked on a little Ho'oponopono that Lita teaches so beautifully. And I did the Zikr that Hugh teaches so beautifully, which is another breathing practice. And before too long, I was in a place where I was open. I was open to hearing this feedback, and I really actually was welcoming it. And I was able to respond to this person with this spirit of welcome, like, absolutely, come and speak to me. And in my heart, I was knowing, I'm going to get to learn something here. I'm going to get to learn something new about myself. You know, and I thought about, every time I wanted to pick up the armor of defensiveness, I thought about, what is it that you're trying to defend? What are you trying to defend? What are you holding on to? You know, I thought about this great story that Judy Pando has shared many times about Pema Chodron. And Pema Chodron was really irked at Pema Chodron is a Buddhist monk, if you don't know, and she was really irked, I think, at another monk, and another female monk. You know, I guess monks get angry too. And she realized that she was upset with this monk because this other monk was, quote-unquote, causing her to feel something that she didn't want to feel. Causing Pema Chodron to feel something that she didn't want to feel. So I said to myself, what is this person who wrote me this email? What is it? What do I not want to feel? And I didn't want to feel wrong. I didn't want to feel like I had made a mistake. I didn't want to feel guilty. I didn't want to feel like a failure. And most of all, I didn't want to feel like a disappointment. And even more than that, I didn't want to feel ashamed. All of these things that we scurry around trying not to feel, all of these things that get us into trouble when we don't feel them and just embrace them and recognize that this is God too. One of the things that I think we I don't know whether we do a disservice or not. I don't know what the rest of the movement is doing. I know that we don't tend to do this here. But as we're affirming, I am wonderful, I am powerful, I am great, there is a yes and in that too. Sometimes I am not so wonderful. Sometimes I am a disappointment. Sometimes I fail. And all of that is beautiful in its own way. You know, as soon as we can tolerate the idea that sometimes we are going to fail, sometimes we are going to let people down. If you are human, if you have a big life, you are going to let people down. If you're a parent, oh my God, are you ever going to let people down, right? That's what my niece says. She's got a 2-year-old, and she was saying to me, you know, I disappoint somebody every day, and you're looking at him right now. He's there throwing a tantrum on the floor because he didn't get what he wanted. So it's just part of life, and I feel so, you know, like Ernest Holmes is spinning in his grave when I say, no, just affirm, acknowledge that you can be a disappointment sometimes, and it's okay. It is okay. Just acknowledge it and accept it and befriend it, and then it doesn't hurt. It becomes your friend, and it moves you into something greater. It moves you into Rumi's field, where that place where the soul is too full to talk about, there's a beautiful fullness that happens when we embrace all of the forsaken parts of ourselves. And what I learned from Dot is that we deserve more love, not less, no matter what. If we are losing control or too controlling, we deserve more love, not less. If we are feeling guilty, we deserve more love, not less. If we are feeling like a disappointment or shameful, we deserve more love, not less. And that love will heal us and bring us to a new place, as it did with me in this encounter. Because as I was doing the work in consciousness, as I was doing the work in consciousness to be in a place where I was receptive to this feedback that this person had to give me, oddly enough, she was doing the work in consciousness too. And when we met together, it was a love fest. And I remember saying to her, please tell me, how can I be better? How can I be better? How can I serve you better? And she was saying things like, you know, I don't really think that was a mistake that you made anymore. And I'm like, no, I do think it was a mistake. I think I could be better. I think I could be better. So now we're fighting about whether or not I made a mistake, you know, in a beautiful way. So it was so sweet and so loving. And I just hope that I remember to do that all the time when somebody is upset with me, because it was the best experience. I've been in such a good mood all week because of that experience, because this person was mad at me, and I let myself feel like a disappointment, and I held it, and I embraced it, and I healed it, and it feels so good. And I know that for all of you. I know that for all of you, that if there is something that you are afraid to feel, see a practitioner, get some prayer, allow yourself to feel it, and then just learn to love it. We deserve more love, not less. Now. Okay, good. So, now, one of the beauties about this situation that I described is that it happened with somebody that is part of this denomination, somebody who is very conscious and somebody who is working on themselves. And I'm wondering if there are any yes butters sitting in the in the congregation. Do you know what a yes butter is? Yes, but. Yeah. So that may work for Bonnie and this other person, but what about the person in my life who doesn't even work on himself, who doesn't attend this church, who doesn't really know observation and awareness, who won't even ask for directions to Rumi's Field? You know, what about that person? Well, I think the example that I gave about Arun Dada and his neighbor might have been an example of that. But I also have an in-house example of somebody who works with somebody who doesn't go to this church, who might have been her yes butter. I'm going to have Lonnie come up in a minute and tell a little bit about this encounter and this experience. But first, I want to just say a few words about Lonnie. Lonnie is a beautiful, beautiful member of this spiritual center. She was the board president for several years. But the thing I love most about Lonnie, or one of the things I love most about Lonnie, beyond her great heart and her great sense of humor and her great love, is that whenever there is a dumpster on a church cleanup day, where can you find Lonnie? In the dumpster. You really do like to go in the dumpster, don't you? Yeah, she likes to go in the dumpster and jump around and press things down. So let's give a big hand for our dumpster diving former board president.
Oh boy, it's kind of, I parked by a dumpster.
Did you?
On Calorama, and I was like, oh my God, I love a dumpster.
Well,
I really do.
Control yourself when you leave,
I will
okay?
Try, right. So. I'm so honored to be the contrast to Bonnie's story. I love this center. It's this philosophy, this love has changed my life in so many different ways. Unfortunately, I haven't let it in much in my professional life. And, you know, I work in a sometimes aggressive environment. I'm a bureaucrat. And I say no a lot. And so we get a lot of opportunity to work with people that are burning Rumi's Field most of the time. And I don't see the God in them. And I've been very resistant to that. And yet, you know, this year for me, I decided that I was going to break up with my soulmate, Fear. And be careful when you do that, because then you start having radical love, compassion, forgiveness, all the things that you really want to do with people that you like, not with the ones you don't like. And so it brings me back to work. We have an individual that my team encounters every once in a while, more than we like to, that is super aggressive. And it's more like an interrogation when you're in a meeting with this individual. And I've had many of my staff come back just pale after this interaction. And so being a good bureaucrat, I like to make rules. And so I made a rule for my team, and it's like, if you're in a meeting with this individual, you need to come get me so that we can tag team them. If not, you just excuse yourself because it's not going to go well. I'm going to back up. It's like, when I go to work, I'm not Gandhi. I'm more like a SWAT team. So that's how I enter my office and take on the day. So I figure, you know, if I'm sitting in my SWAT gear, then I'll just call him Elmer. Won't misbehave. Au contraire. So, you know, I'm really practicing with these people that cause me to be in my fear mode, that fight or flight. And I did use some of Chris's practice of the breathing. I still feel like I want to get the you-know-what out of there, either that or kick their you-know-what. It's a toss-up. So one of my team had the misfortune to go to a meeting that she didn't realize Elmer was going to participate in. And she got there, and he started doing his interrogation, accusatory dialogue, and she excused herself. She said, I need to professionally excuse myself from this meeting, which I thought, oh, good, she's listening to me. It's not all the time, do they? So, you know, she came down, and she asked me, like, from the meeting, you know, can you come up with me? You know, well, can you make this meeting? I said, not really. Just go up and say, you know, you're going to be excusing yourself from the meeting entirely, and then if they have any questions, they can let us know via, like, email or something, you know, sort of sterile. So I was really, really proud of that. And then I got the you know, the blowback of that, how unprofessional she was, how what a disservice we were providing, and I felt very defensive about that. And yet, it started to churn something up, is that she and I share sort of the same experience when we deal with people that are in your face, is I just freeze. I'm not of good service to them. And she and I had a great conversation about, you know, really the best thing and most loving thing to do for ourselves is to just state that. And it's really hard to do when you're basically, you know, from my human side saying, I'm not enough. I can't handle this situation. I'm small, and I need to excuse myself. And yet, I think, like, the paradox is that's very powerful because you're just being honest. And I'm really excited now to go back to my workplace and be able to just be honest. When I'm in a situation that I'm feeling really fearful and I've lost my ability to be of service or share my gifts in my profession, I'm going to be courageous enough to say that. And it'll be okay if they don't understand that. And so since you're here today, I would just invite you to really embrace this, because it's not perfect for me yet, but in my heart, I know that it's going to change things for me, and I'm really tired of being in that fight or flight mode all the time, and the SWAT outfit's getting a little tight, so I think I'd rather wear something loose.
Thank you, Lonnie. Thank you. So that was so beautiful. Thank you. And what I heard in that is that it's surrendering to truth. It's not pretending that you can take on this person, right? It's surrendering to the truth. I really can't help you when my body is feeling tense and jittery. I need to step back. And how kind and how loving that is, right? So my question for you is, do you have anybody challenging in your life at all? And if you do, is there a way that you can apply these principles? You know, one of the things that I hear a lot in religious science is that, I remember Terry Cole Whitaker saying this. Jesus said, these things ye shall do and more. And she said, so Jesus raised the dead and healed the sick. And Terry Cole Whitaker said, and I'm practicing on dead birds, you know. I'm going to raise some of those dead birds. You know what? I'm not sure if he meant that, if we're literally going to raise dead birds or dead anything else. And we certainly do heal the sick through prayer, but the healing and the cure is not always what we think. And I think these things ye shall do and more means that I'm expressing these principles that every great spiritual teacher, Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, whoever, are expressing these spiritual principles, and we can take them, these unifying spiritual principles, and express them in the multiplicity, in all of the tiny little details in our lives where they come up. That's what these things ye shall do and more. We shall express them. We shall express them and live them so that the world is lifted up and that we are lifted up with the world. Let's do that now, and let us pray.